when you're cooking spaghetti and you figure out like take it out, throw it against the wall if it sticks, okay, that's good. And so every day was like spaghetti days, right? Like, here's some ways I want to try to play, and then you leave practice going, no, that ain't it.
Welcome back to the Coach's Playbook Podcast. I'm your host, Wyatt Faust. Thanks for tuning back in. We've got a really awesome show lined up for you today, so let's jump right in. We're going to tip it off with a little three-point play. We got something for college coaches, high school coaches, and recruits. The first point is going to be high school specific, and it's going to be a late game situation that you're just going to have to consider without having the advance rule. A full court play with 5 seconds or so is a really low percentage, tough to execute, and very unpredictable type play. If you've got two timeouts, I would definitely recommend using a post player or a really good athlete and trying to get a deep inbound somewhere around half court. Take a dribble or two up the sideline near the coach's box and take a timeout. If you have two timeouts, you can take one late, get a really deep inbound somewhere around half court, take one or two really hard dribbles and get it deep up the sideline. And now, instead of running a full court play with maybe around 5 seconds to go, you're running a sideline play with 3 or 4 seconds, which is going to be a much more efficient, easier to connect on play. So something that I picked up from Coach Tim Riley when I worked for him at Owensboro Catholic on the boys' side, and I always thought that was a really, really smart idea at the high school level. The second point is for college coaches. First off, I think two-for-one situations are criminally underused and under-attacked. You may have three times a game where you run into situations where you could go for two-for-ones and find yourself three extra possessions in that game. And, of course, you have to trust your team to get the defensive rebound on your defensive possession. But those might be three really big possessions. And even if the shot quality isn't quite what you would want or be hunting, I think you can still get something up on the rim and give yourself a good chance to steal a bucket or two throughout the course of a game. If you can get the shot off around 42 to even 50 seconds, you got a nice buffer there where you can earn that second possession going for 2-for-1. Something really cool I picked up watching the NCAA tournament last year was a team who actually did a 2-for-1 kill. So really smart by the team who was on defense. They knew the other team was going for a 2-for-1, and you could hear the coach audibly yelling something, whatever their term was, for their guys to cue them to take their time inbounding it. And so instead of sprinting to inbound and throw it in quick like they normally do, their inbounder walks very slowly, grabs the ball, and then gives it a good 2 or 3 count before he inbounds it. In the first 3 quarters of the game, the clock's not going to stop after a made basket. And so you can make sure, even if the other team does get it off and they're 2-for-1, that you're going to get the last shot. And this doesn't even have to be in situations where the other team is intentionally going for two for ones. These things can naturally happen, and if you're prepared for those and you've got some kind of call for those and you're proactive and you think ahead as a coach, that's a call you can be calling from the sideline to make sure that in those situations you're guaranteeing that your team gets the last shot in those quarters. All right, the last point is for high school recruits in regards to college elite camps. Might catch some hate from some college coaches on this one, but I think it's important for recruits to know and fully have a grasp on what everything looks like. First of all, it kind of depends what you want out of the elite camp. You might just be going because you want to pick up some drills, you want to compete, you want to see where you're at, and get worked out by the college coaches and their staff. And if that's the case, then great. I'd encourage everyone to attend any elite camp if that's what you're looking for and that's what you want to get out of it. On the flip side, if you're going to get recruited, or maybe the school invited you, I think there's some questions you should probably ask yourself, but also ask the school. Did the school call you? if there's players I really want to get to our league camp because I'm genuinely interested in evaluating them further, or we want to spend some time with them and do some things, we will for sure talk to that player and probably their family on the phone before we invite them to a league camp. If a school is blasting out emails, even if your name's on it, you know, it may not be the most genuine invite. I know there's been instances in the past I've known where schools will pick up the AAU tournament book that they had to buy. They'll find every team that is within a geographic radius of their school and literally just invite every player on those teams as a moneymaker and a fundraiser for their programs. But I think a great question and a fair question to ask those coaches who have invited you to league camp, ask them what they liked about your game or maybe things that you can work on and improve on. If you get a really vanilla answer, it's probably a good sign that they really didn't know or they really aren't sure. If someone's serious about recruiting you, then they have had multiple coaches evaluate you. They've done their homework and they've taken their time. And so they're definitely going to have a pretty good answer and response for any questions like that. You can also ask what their recruitment plan looks like and what is their schedule and how do they approach all those things. I tell the players we recruit all the time, listen, this is your recruitment. So ask the tough questions, ask the hard questions. If there's anything you're curious about, ask, because the school is going to do their homework and you need to too. Today's guest has set the coaching world on fire. In just 2 years as a head coach at Chattanooga, Coach Sean Poppy has put together a pair of 20-win seasons and turned around a 7-win Chattanooga program in just year one. In both his seasons at the helm, they were NCAA tournament bound by winning the SoCon, and after his first season, he was named the NCAA Division I Rookie Coach of the Year. Today's guest has been a proven winner at every stop along the way throughout different levels across the NCAA. He's coached at Division II level. He was an associate head coach at Virginia Tech, following that up as a head coach at Chattanooga before landing at his current position as the head coach for the Clemson Tigers. Coach Poppy's an all-world dude who's known as a high-energy guy who brings a ton of passion to practice and to the sidelines every single day. He's an ultimate competitor, but his players absolutely love him. We're super fortunate to have Coach Sean Poppy on the podcast today. Coach Poppy, thanks for joining the podcast, man.
I appreciate you having me, brother. It's good to be here this time of year.
Yeah, no kidding. And you guys are sitting at 2-0, so it's even better to be sitting here, undefeated. Doesn't matter how far into the season, that feels good too.
Well, you know, it's funny. We keep talking about that honeymoon stage. You get a new job, and in that 6-month gap leading up to your first games, you're still in that honeymoon phase. So now that we're 2-0, we're still the back end of this honeymoon, right? At some point it's going to end, but we'll enjoy it while it still lasts.
Every minute of it. I've got good intel that you're a big sneakerhead. How many pairs you got?
You know, it's interesting. Now that we're back in this Nike deal school, it's helped my shoe game for sure. But it's killed my bank account and wallet since getting this job. I would say, I don't know, I'm not like as crazy as some. I probably got 25 or 30 pairs of J's. You mix in with some dunks on top of that. You're probably, 35, 40 in.
Okay. All right. That's pretty deep. But I mean, is there a sacred pair, like must win game? I'm pulling these out.
Man, no. It's interesting you say that because for me, I'm more superstitious of like, I may wear the same one over and over again because we've won in them. And so I don't get to that sacred pair because you find a little winning streak, you end up wearing the same, one or two sets of shoes. So I don't know if I have a sacred because I've really added to this collection since getting back to Clemson. So there's a handful in there that I want to pull out that I'm going to save for the right occasion.
Yeah. And you also, worst case scenario is you bust out a pair you love, take a loss, and you're like, well, so much for them, man. Then we're retired.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I did that same piece down, when we were at Chattanooga, I bought a new set of Yeezys, and they were one and done. That was an expensive one and done game.
That's real. If you're in coaching, you get it. That's too real. By the way, congrats on your 50th win. When you're only two seasons and two games into it, that's a pretty remarkable feat. So congrats there, man.
Well, I sure appreciate that. You know, I don't know. You're not in this, at least I'm not in this business for myself. Something like that really, for me here at Clemson, two games in, I got a handful of my staff here at Clemson has been with me for all 50. So that was pretty cool for me of, you know, we get to celebrate a little bit of that as a group. Not only a couple staff members, but Addie Grace Porter, who left, you know, Chattanooga, came with us here to Clemson. She's been a part of all 50 as well. So thankful for the group I've had around me. And as you know, it takes a village in this thing. So I've been very, very fortunate and blessed to be around the right people.
Yeah, man. And that's not just something you're saying. You know, I think everybody gets to portray whatever image they want. You know, we've got camera crews all the time filming stuff and what a great person we are and how, you know, and we can put whatever we want out there on social media. But yeah, when you say it, you mean it, man. I know what a family guy you are. A lot of people get lost in this thing. I actually had Coach Frelick at Michigan State on, and one of the terms she used that I thought was so cool was she talked about work-life integration. I asked about work-life balance, and she talks about work-life integration, and I'm like, man, that hit me on the head, and that was, like, so awesome. And I know that's something that, you know, from talking with your folks, you know, like, you have your, you know, your family around, and other staff members have their family around, and even at your level, to not lose sight of that, I think that's awesome.
I'm going to have to use that. I love that. You're exactly right on that. We try to, for us, it's just like we preach family, but to do it, you better live it too, you know, and that's not only, you know, my kids, it's my staff kids, and it could be parents of some staff. We have open practices, so our first game of the year, I think we had five sets of parents of our players and come be a part of it, right? And we're not hiding anything. We want y'all to be a part of it. It's special, and you can't preach it and not live it. But I tell you what, the other piece of that is I've had, again, back to being around good people. I mean, I got three kids, all boys, 8, 3, and 1, right? So them being around ain't just like there's other people around. It's chaos. And so for them to have open arms and kind of be really aunts and uncles, really, of my kids has been really cool to watch.
Yeah, getting pressed don't bother you when you're used to having like 8 people on the floor all the time anyway. So that's right, what's great, yeah, about having that crew around. You had a historic playing career at Limestone University, you know, in the all-time record books. I mean, assists and steals, I think 11th all-time leading scorer there. And you're obviously in good shape. You still play any pickup? You doing any noon ball or going to the rec league and getting out there, man?
I gave it up a couple years ago. I really did. I tell you what, like, one little movement and you feel like you pulled a hamstring. I'm like, the last thing I want to do is end up in these boots or these leg braces that you see some of these coaches in on the sidelines from trying to still live their glory days. So with that said, I have been running recently to get back in good enough shape because Dabo runs a really good noon ball game over in the football facility every Wednesday. And I've been giving him heck about not getting an invite. I'm like, I've been here 6 months. Where's the invite? And he's like, you're on the wait list. So as I'm on that wait list, maybe I can get on that treadmill, get in shape so that when my number's called, I may get out there a little bit more.
Yeah. You're gonna have to stay ready. There's probably no getting ready for that, man. But hey, anybody that's watched you coach, they know you've got that quick twitch. I mean, watching your teams play is fun. Watching you coach them for me is probably as fun. I don't know. I've seen anybody get out of a crouch into a three step quick sprint like you. You know, and man, that you probably the all time great is the commitment gif that you had, the midair splits to the Tiger Wood fist pump. That was pretty elite, Coach.
Well, you know, it's interesting because some people, you know, hopefully don't feel like it's me trying to gain any kind of attention, right? It's a genuine myself. You come in practice, it's the same way. It's no different than I ask my team to bring energy every day. We're doing the same thing, not only myself, my staff. And when you can be consistent with that. Now, in a game, as we all are, I'm pretty competitive. And so that maybe bring out a little extra juice. But all that is obviously wanting win, but really most importantly, want the best for my kids, right? They're pouring into this thing, and you want to see them get what they deserve. And so definitely animated over there, but that's some passion. That's a daily thing. But again, we preach that as well, right? And again, you can't preach it and then not live it.
Nah, yeah, and it is. I mean, when you know the person, you know it's authentic. And it's not like you're out on the floor trapping people. I mean, I've seen some coaches that, I mean, they get out there and they're, I mean, they got them right there at the across half court. You know, that's next level. But let's talk about the turnaround at Chat. I mean, you follow a, you know, you come into a 7-win team, and you know your first season, you go in there, 20 games, win the league. Win the NCAA Division I Rookie Coach of the Year. I think a lot of people were obviously surprised by that. Did that immediate success surprise you too?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, I think anytime you take over any program like that, like you try to understand it's going to be a process, right? You're going to try to figure out a couple things you want to establish. You know, for me, there was so many things you wanted to fix, right? Culturally, just how we run the program, and really try to simplify a handful of things and work on those with the understanding that, you know, if we do the right things, that we're going to give ourselves an opportunity. But to think we would go win 20 and win a conference tournament, I think we'd all be lying to think that was realistic, right? Now, I do believe once we got 5-6 games into it, I looked around and said, we were not going to have the most talent in this league, but if we keep putting this thing together and get closer and closer with how we're coaching, we're going to give ourselves an opportunity. And we took advantage of it. You know, like the honest truth is that Wofford was the best team in the league that first year and waxed us both home and, you know, at home and at Wofford in the regular season. And, you know, we had an opportunity to get them in a championship game and really throw the kitchen sink at them in a one game series, right? We had nothing else to hold on to. And, we're able to execute that and credit to our kids for buying in and executing. And, so we got to reap the reward of getting our name called for, you know, on that selection Sunday. And then, of course, get sent to Blacksburg, of all places, that runs to a Final Four. But it was a fun experience. But no, I don't think any of us expected that. It was, you know, stay the course, keep the process moving, be patient with it, and but also understand, like, I did think we had a team that could compete.
So how did you establish, like, how you're going to play that season? Did you go in like, hey, here's some actions I love and here's what I want to do? Or is it, hey, let's see what we got. Let's figure this thing out. Let's put the best product on the team right now that can win.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny you say that. I feel like all my summers have been like, I call it spaghetti. I got that from Kenny Brooks. And like when you're cooking spaghetti and you figure out, like, take it out, throw it against the wall. If it sticks, okay, that's good. And so every day was like spaghetti days, right? Like, here's some ways I want to try to play. And then you'd leave practice going, no, that ain't it, right? And you literally all summer, that's all we did. I don't know how many different styles we felt like we were going to play throughout the summer. But I think what was cool with it is that, and really helped us down the road, ultimately what we were doing was just teaching them how to play basketball regardless, right? So even if the style didn't stick, you know, I think that a lot of our, what we call our absolutes, stuck, right? And how to, you know, drive, kick, find eyes, one more, and share the basketball, that part stuck. And with that said, I wanted to play some free-flowing motion offense, but as I learned that team, you know, it needed to be dictated every time down the floor. But I think ultimately, really, what if you watch us the 2 years there compared to where I had been as an assistant, the pace of the game really slowed down. Right. I did not play as fast as I had when we were at Virginia Tech. But again, that's looking at yourself in the mirror and realize we don't have the firepower to go score 70, 80, 90 points on it, you know, every single night. And so the best way was, you know, let's minimize possessions and become efficient. And if we do that, we'll have an opportunity. And then on the flip side, we became really good defensively, like top 15 in the country both years in a program that was 298th the year we got there is a huge turnaround. That gives you an opportunity to win. But we also didn't have to go guard 80 possessions. We were guarding only 55, right? So if you can be pretty good in 55 instead of 80, it gave you an opportunity.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's a great, like, segue. Like, you're just looking at the numbers, you know, like, I think point per possession, I don't care if you play fast, play slow, it's probably you split your offensive and defensive point per possession, and I can look at those and tell you how good you were, how many, you know, how many games you won within reason probably. And, you know, for you guys in year one, you know, like you're talking about – You know, and this is what I'm curious about too is, okay, like you knew you were going to play slow. You knew you were going to limit the possessions, grind people out. So you knew you were going to be in a lot of late clock situations. Well, if you're going to be in a lot, you know, you better be great at what happens most. If you're going to be in a lot, let's be great at it. Well, you guys were in the 94th percentile in, you know, in point per possession when there were less than 4 seconds on the clock.
Yeah.
Was that a thing like, okay, you know, was that intentional? Was that just a byproduct of we just do it so much? You know, did you have a handful of actions that in those moments, you know, you love to go to? How'd that kind of piece together?
Yeah, that was a daily debate in our staff meetings, you know. Shoot, we're having them right now, like, because we're playing a mixture of some transition and then getting in that, you know, late clock. And, you know, all my staff, we got to get in a bunch of, you know, little actions to finish the shot clock. I'm like, I don't want that. We're just going to keep playing. Right, going to keep playing. And do we have a couple? Absolutely. But I just feel like kids, the more you give them an out to do that, it's going to be 11 on the clock. We're going to back the damn thing out and going to have to start over again. And so for us, it's like find ourselves into right understanding who we are, the ball get to the right person, and try to make a play for us late clock within our actions, right? Like we're running some Princeton stuff. We ran some of that. We ran, you know, just some high ball screens naturally at Chattanooga. And instead of making it a big deal, we just let them keep playing, right? And I think sometimes when you try to make it a big deal, then they overthink it. And then like, golly, like it's, then you get tense, right? Well, you can't be tense late clock, right? And then also I think too is like, we were in it so much. Like we had possessions where we took shot clock violations and I can't get mad at that. Right. It's like, it's all right. We'll get the next possession. And so it didn't ever allow them to have, you know, negative emotions towards late clock and, or coach mad at me. Cause we didn't execute every possession because there was plenty that we were pretty darn good late clock. And I thought a lot of that was, we just continued to play right within, again, our motions are different from Chattanooga to Clemson, but how we were playing in the motion, late clock stayed true, during our time at Chattanooga.
Yeah. I think you bring up a couple like really cool things that every coach, you know, needs to consider and things that you just, you do it long enough, you see it, you just, you know, when teams, you know, when the clock hits 11 and your entire bench starts counting down, I mean, that there's a lot of things that can, that's a third of the clock. There's a lot of good things that can still happen,
right.
But everybody's just freaks out. You know, and you, so then you get into your, whatever, if it's just a high middle ball screen, but when that's kind of who you are. And like you said, I love how you talk about like, there's a natural flow within what we do as we're hitting those late clocks and over the course of time, the shot clock violation we take will be washed out by the amount of good natural possessions we get. You know, when you go to a late clock thing and if we're like, you know, hey, 10, you know, like whatever, head tap, bring it. Well, the other team is going to be pretty settled and going to get their best coverage. And you rarely get really high quality shots in those moments.
100%.
Same thing for end of clock.
Well, and it becomes scoutable again, right? Like that's the thing about today's game. Like transition is the hardest. I mean, again, you better be just good at transition defense, but it's not scoutable in a sense. Like the game is coming so fast. Anytime you stop and slow the ball down, there's so much dang film and tendencies that it becomes a heck of a lot harder to score and or expect that if you're going against a good coach, that they're not going to have some kind of wrinkle when you do back that thing out, right? Like, you look at some teams now, and this is really more like late quarter, maybe not as much late clock, but NC State does it quite a bit. I don't know if they'll do it this year, but you back it out to half court, and all of a sudden they're running into a 2-3 zone defense, right? Or all of a sudden here come they're going to go come run and jump you, and they're going to speed you up and make sure like you don't get to run something at the end of, you know, a quarter or a clock, and so. Instead of having all that, just keep playing, right? Keep playing and take some of the coaching out of it, right? Sometimes we want to overcoach and or allow the other team to be good coaches.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I heard an awesome quote a while back, and a guy was talking. He said, you know, if you're not good at transition defense, you don't get to play any other kind. So, you know, you if you pick one phase of defense you'd be good at, it better be transition. But I really, really like that.
I got a question on that, right? This is me back to you. I know this is conversational, just starter. Like, I think some of transition defense is how hard you crash, right? Like, are you in the NBA style? Everybody's getting back, right? And or how hard do you crash? You send everybody, right? Which forces everyone to rebound. Like I'm watching our Clemson men and how many people attack the glass. Cause I think natural is like, if you send that many people, who's back? Well, you continue to get offensive rebounds. Like it slows transition offense up too, you know? And so I think that's a huge debate that I've never really thought of both ways, but I've always been more so the shot goes up and we're scared of transition. Like I'm screaming, get back. Right.
Yeah. I think with everything, it's like, to me, it comes down, is the juice worth the squeeze? If we're getting the boards and we're sticking them back and we're getting extra possessions and, you know, and we're getting more than you're getting behind us, you know, I think that's worth it. And, you know, and I think too, like, you know, like your style, if you're playing a minimal possession style, you know, I'm probably getting everybody back too. And I'm making sure I'm going to grind you out for every ounce. If you're a, you know, if you're a high, you know, high volume team where 2, 4 points, whatever doesn't bother you, but you know, you need to rack up possessions, you know, kind of where we're at, you know, we're trying to get 100 possessions a game. Well, you're only going to get them by getting some O boards and you're pressing anyway, people are getting behind you anyway. So, you know, typically, you know, that it is. And I tell you what, I don't know if you've ever heard of the concept, but, there's a concept called tagging up.
Yeah. That's what our men are doing right now. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So the guy that's at Charlotte, right now kind of, you know, kind of brought that over, and it's an unbelievably cool, you know, idea. And I think there's a lot to it. And I talk with him a lot about it. You know, Aaron Fern's his name, if you want to look up what they do, but, you know, they kind of, when a shot goes up, they all run straight to their guy, wedge them. They'll take the long boards that go over your head, but they're not going to get that underneath position. And then if you do, you know, if you do get the rebound, they're right there. They're in gaps, they're on ball, and there's nowhere to go. There's no way to get behind them. It's a pretty cool philosophy if you can execute it. But if you're not great at it, I mean, you got to commit to it.
They practiced all darn summer. I mean, that's where a shot goes up. They're all screaming, tag, tag, tag. It was new concept to me. But, yeah, just it's more curiosity, because I've been in positions where it's just been get your butts back. But, you know, the more you do crash and slow people down, that like, that's part of transition defense too.
Yeah, no, for sure. Do you think, you know, like talking about, you know, styles and stuff, do you think the way you play has to be synergistic? Like, do you think there's a ton of value in that? Do you think that's something that's overthought? You know, like it's probably, you know, not, can you play super fast on offense and then sit back and be super passive and just let them pass around defense? You know, how important is that synergy between, you know, your styles, you know, on both sides of the ball?
You know, it's interesting because for me, like we're playing much faster here at Clemson than I did the last 2 years. And for me, I just continue to preach together. Like we got to play together regardless of what side of the ball we're on. And whether that be on offense, like we may play fast, but can you make the right play, right? Like it's not one-on-one, do it yourself. Like how are we, I mean, how many assists to field goal makes are we getting a game? And so, because ultimately that's what I'm asking on the other side of the ball, right? Like for us, we're pack line, keep the ball in front. We're not going to get out and deny, but it's a togetherness, and you better be locked in two passes away just as much as you are on the ball. And, you know, I've noticed a lot of times teams that are the up and down, especially at this level, and I've gotten transfers and you just hear stories of where they come from and their styles was, it's all such individualistic, right? Like, all right, you have your man, and when it's your turn to guard, you guard everything else. You just chase them around and make it tough for them to catch, but it's so much on islands. And so, I've kind of preached for us, cause that's just not how we work, the complete opposite of that. Right. And trying to be faster on offense, but much slower on defense. And, to me, it's just been more so we just preach the togetherness piece rather than it's gotta be fast both ways. Ultimately, your style has to be based on what can your team perform to be successful. And, you know, that's where I'm trying to find the balance with my team is like, I think we are capable to score, and we're going to have to play in transition, but then what's the balance of that to slowing it down and trying to get some actions and, or into our motion, on the defensive side of the ball, we have no choice. In my opinion, we don't have enough depth and athleticism at guards to guard you 94 feet and make it chaotic. but we're also not long enough to sit back in a zone or even really deny and pressure you, right? Like, it's going to have to be gaps to protect one another for us to have success. So we're going to try to play slow on defense and faster than I have on offense, because I think that's what this team has to do to win basketball games.
Yeah, and you know, I think there's a lot of, this is how I want to do it, this is who I am, I'm not, you know, like, I would rather win than be right. You know, I think there's a lot of, you know, ego checking that probably needs to happen when people are thinking about all those things. And, you know, you see teams that, you know, they might be playing a style, you're like, oh, man, I'm glad they're doing this, because life would be a lot harder if, you know, they were doing something else. So, right. All right, Coach, so what did you learn at Virginia Tech that really prepared you to take over as a head coach? And, you know, what advice do you have for, like, assistants now that, you know, now that you're on that side of it, you're like, man, you know, these things were really important, you know, that I was doing or I should have been doing more of to really, you know, help out.
I think, I mean, you learn so much along the way. Like, you're going to learn a lot of what to do and a lot of like what not to do. Right. Like, I think that's okay. I tell my staff same thing. Like, there's a lot of things when they leave me, if they're to become a head coach, that hopefully they take with them, but there's going to be a lot that don't fit their personality. And so that's okay. Right. So making a list of things that you'd want to do when it's your turn, but also make sure it's okay. Like, while your 2 feet are where they're at, right, you got to agree with what the head coach is doing, but it's also your job to I think, as you're moving forward, to understand, like, hey, this would not be what I would do. And, you know, I think I learned a lot of that early on. My biggest thing at Virginia Tech under Kenny Brooks is just the value of the relationships with your kids, right? And allowing them to have a voice to get a feel of just how things are going on and off the court, but also the amount of time you're putting, as a head coach especially, on the court with them, one-on-one, right? It's in this business, it's so much, I don't know, whether you're recruiting and you're spending so much time trying to find the next, and or you have a system and you're hard-headed and this is just how we're going to do things, compared to putting kids in the best places along with being on the court so you know where those places are. He did an unbelievable job of individual player development, but also teaching them where they're going to get it within how he wants to play. But all that is so relational. And he was the best that I've ever been around of giving them a voice, but you're having such a one-on-one relationship with each of your kids. So they know exactly how you're thinking and vice versa while you're challenging them, right? Like, he was tough on them, but he loved on them even harder. And it's something I've really tried to take with me, you know, from there. I think the second piece is that you can have any, like, you got to understand where you're at. Like, you're at Murray State, I'm now at Clemson, he's now at Kentucky. Like, when you're at an institution, there's certain kids you're going to attract to those kind of institutions. And who can you get at your institution that can help you be successful? And I think that you look around until you get to the Blue Bloods, that's a little bit different world, right? They get the pick of the litter. But, like, when we were at Furman, there's only a select kind of kids you're going to get, and you better find a system or style that fits the kind of kids you can get. And that's great what point. I think, for me, he wasn't going to waste his time at Virginia Tech, especially early on, and going and chasing a bunch of top 25 kids. Like, the reality was they weren't coming there, and he was going to invest his time and interest on kids he could help turn into top 25. Right. And taking kids like, Georgia Amore and Liz Kitley and Kayla King and like kids that were getting recruited, but like not to that level. But they fit what Virginia Tech was, right? The type of kids that normally come to Virginia Tech. And, you know, I think that we're trying to do the same thing here at Clemson, and then put a system around it that can be successful to that kind of style of kid, and not forcing a style on the reality of what you can recruit. And so I think that allows you to develop in an even better way, because they're going to have an opportunity for success.
Yeah, that looking in the mirror and knowing who you are, accepting who you are, and finding a way to win with who you are and where you, I mean, that's all huge. I mean, there's not a coach that, you know, that can't sit here and make up 20 reasons why it's hard to win. It's hard to win everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. 100%. Yeah.
It's just so easy to get in that moment.
And you can sit and sulk, and they do it there and we can't get them because of that. And it's like, well, okay, well, how do you go find the right ones that can help beat them? right? Like, and we used to always, especially as that thing got going, like, we got zero McDonald's All-Americans, and we just beat X, Y, and Z who had seven of them, right? Like, right. It's okay. It can be done if you get the right people, instead of always, well, it can't be done, or chasing your tail, going and really, and again, like, you got to figure it out, like, when that changes. Like, I think it has for him, right? The type of kids you go and recruit based on the success, too. But that keeps you, I think, from going crazy in this business, especially on the recruiting side of things.
Yeah, for sure. You know, so I'm watching a nationally televised game, opening day. I won't mention any names because Lord knows you'll probably play them, and we're not trying to pump out bulletin board material. Side note, do you believe in that? Like, is that something, like, do you tell your players, is that something you address or even tell your players, like, hey, let's be smart, let's not, you know, do you use it if you see, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you know, we definitely use it. You know, I haven't had opportunity to have to use it here yet, but, like, you know, we definitely used it in my time at Chattanooga. Like, there was a lot of, you know, just stuff you'd hear and see. Whether it be from kids' social media that you've screenshot, or coaches that – maybe just, and they may not even take shots at us, but don't give respect when it's our turn, you know? And so, it was stuff we used. I don't talk too much about our current kids, using, you know, any of that. Cause I think we're still trying to find our own confidence, to be honest with you. Right? It's hard to take shots at anybody else when you're trying to search for your own. but it is something, you know, I think that, especially in 2024 with social media, that we have access to so much, and you do got to be careful, without a doubt.
Yeah, I tell, when I was a head coach and we were playing a really great player that, you know, you could get them going and they like to talk trash. We would tell them all the time, hey, you know, if you foul them, pick them up, tell them you're sorry, tell them how great they are. You know, just let them keep coasting, let them cruise. Let's not. You know, let's not wake these dudes up any more than they
are.
Yeah,
don't poke the bear. Do not poke the bear.
No. But, you know, I got off topic. I got sidetracked because that stuff always intrigues me. But so I'm watching a game, and, you know, one team is very, you know, they're very set oriented. They run their stuff. They're great at executing their stuff. And, you know, but the other team is extremely disruptive defensively. You know, those teams that, you know, they're denying elbow entries like crazy. They're pushing your offense out. They're messing up your timing, your spacing, your entry points, all those things that are nice and pretty all preseason, you know, and next thing you know, like, you know, they're just, you know, in a game that maybe they shouldn't be, things like that. When you play a team like that, somebody that you know is just going to, you know, cause all kinds of chaos, you know, and especially you've got some experience, like you said at Chat, you guys ran a lot of stuff, you know, do you almost take a step back and think that the game is just going to have to be a little simpler? Like, hey, let's just take this thing a little higher, a little wider, and you know, use that aggressiveness against them? Or are you going to try to fight for the inches, you know, work on your entries and create, you know, how do you approach those teams like that?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a really good point. Every offense, you better have ways that you can spread them out and try to, again, some kind of dribble drive attack, right? Like, what beats pressure? Well, putting it on the floor and making a play for yourself or others. But you can't get caught up in, especially if it's your style to play slow, like we were at Chattanooga, is that don't get baited into doing it every possession, right? And, like, so for us was, instead of falling to that trap, like, it's more so what is the best way to get entries. Like, we do have a lot of stuff that may start with DHOs that they blow the heck out of, right? Well, we may get into just push through action instead of DHOs that game. And with that said, take our normal spacing and move it about four steps back, right? And if we can get them playing, you know, a whole half court defense and spreading them out, then we will have an opportunity to get into our stuff, and or that's a lot more space for us to make a play, and then to keep playing at our pace, right? Like, again, that's trying to find my balance here at Clemson. But November 20th, we play South Carolina. Like, they're not going to let us get into our stuff, right? Not every possession. But I also know the last 2 years they beat Clemson by 71 and 69 or something crazy like that, because it's been a track meet, right? We cannot play them in a track meet. And I'm going to have to figure out a balance, because you're going to have an opportunity to go, but what's the difference, right? Where do we meet them in the middle? And so our team's definitely at Chattanooga. I mean, we play Alabama that first year. and go down there and had beat, I think, three teams in our league by 35 plus, all three of them, and one of them was favored to win the league, right? And you're going in going, what in the world? We're coming off seven wins. We had, I don't know, 4-2 maybe at the time. And, you know, they're trying to press you and really get after you in the half court. And we've really slowed it down, right? And I feel like, too, teams that pressure you like that, when you can show that you can handle it, the pressure releases, right? Like, it's when you show you can't handle it, it amps up. And so, and especially as the game goes on. And I felt like, almost like the other way around, you lull them to sleep a little bit by being able to just get to your spots and having a little discipline to yourself, and allow to stay in the game. I mean, it's a one possession game under a minute to go. And so I think for us here, again, we're going to have some of that same talks, right, of how do we still run our stuff? I don't care what they're doing. But also as coaches, I can't expect us to, you know, if they do an unbelievable job at blowing up DHOs, well, we better figure something else out, right, and still be able to get in the same action we're trying to get into.
Yeah, that's – I think that's 100% the right approach. I played, you know, as a high school coach, played pack line. We ran a lot of stuff, heavy playbook, a lot of counters, high IQ kids. It was, you know, it was fun, but – you know, when you played those teams that just were not going to let you do it, or they're going to try their best, you have to take the layups when they're there, you know, and you got them, like you said, you got to show them, you know, like we're going to make you pay some, but we're also not going to fall into the trap. Last year was the first year at Murray State. We started playing up and down and pressing the whole game and getting, you know, just trying to get it up and down. And we had probably one, maybe two coaches all year, that just would not take the bait. I mean, we got to the point, we were giving up 3-on-1s. We said, just go have a couple layups. It'll be fun. Just try it. You might like it. And they would circle that 3-on-1 right back out across the free throw line, pull it out, and weave it up top around half court. I mean, we just, and it was great. You know, credit to them. But it was funny to see. And, you know, but that just, it shows the discipline. It shows an idea of a game plan, a game understanding. It's bigger than this 2-on-1 right here over and over and things like that. But, no, I think that's all, you know, I think that's all.
I'm stuff. Interested to see, I mean, kind of on that same talk, like, you know, we played Kim when she was at Marshall last year, right? And obviously their style, now she's at Tennessee. When they get to the SEC play, who will attack at every possession? Because, I mean, you're going against some really good basketball players, or who will, you know, kind of take the bait and slow it down a little bit and have a little balance. So I'm really curious to watch that, because it's back to that same deal, right? Like, they play a completely different style than most people, really anybody in Division I at that level plays. So I'm really curious on how people attack that.
Yeah, I think that's probably the biggest, you know, question mark in all of college basketball. And I'm 100% sure she heard plenty of it going from Division II to Marshall. Well, that's not going to work at the Division I level. And you know, you go win your league with it. And I'm sure she's heard plenty of it, you know. And so
it's hard to prepare. I mean, because it's a totally different, like, that's even – different than just normal pressure, right? Just the amount of times it's coming up and down the court, subbing in, subbing out. So yeah, it'll be very, very interesting, because it's obviously proven to be successful. But again, when you got time to prepare is the difference, right? You play Thursday, Sunday, like the Sunday, I wouldn't want to be on the Sunday. I know that.
Yeah. It's nice in our league. We have travel partners. It's not when your travel partner's pretty good and you get them on Sunday, you know, you write the other guys a thank you card sometimes.
Right. Yeah.
Man, you've coached at the D2 level, mid major, you know, now you're at the Power 4 level. You know, what facets of the game do you feel like are universal? And, you know, are there things that you think worked, but, you know, at one level that you just don't think will work at another level? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, obviously the higher you go up, the more good players there are, right? So, like, defensively, some stuff you used to be able to take away just with some simple coaching ain't going to happen, because there's good players all the way across the floor. You know, at Chattanooga, you're probably going two, maybe three good ones, like really good players on the court at a time. And so it's a little bit easier to take some stuff away, right? And so I think we got to have an understanding at this level, it's a little bit harder to do that. I think also to control the game with set plays every time down the floor is very, very difficult at this level. You're going to have a balance, but I'm not going to be able to have two people get all my shots on a set call, right? Now, like, you have two in free flow motion, maybe, but on a set call, I don't think you can control it as much as you can at some of the lower levels. But with that said, the same thing, like, basketball is basketball. Like, are you making the right play, good to great, in the sense of your shot selection? If you can shoot it, that translates. I don't care where you go. So there's definitely some things along the way, but I do think you got to look in the mirror when it gets to a certain level of just, what's out there.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, having been a high school coach, I think it was one of the best things that happened to me. Like when you're a high school coach, one year your best player might be a 6'2" post, the next year your post might be 5'8". You have to learn to win a thousand different ways defensively. You have to learn to get creative. And, we go into a game and, somebody, there's a guard out there shooting, 18% from three. We might just stick that guy right under the rim and not move him. And there's a lot of things like that that I feel like teams really miss out on at this level. I mean, there's certain people you put on the floor and they come guard them and you're just like, nah, I appreciate it. It's just, seeing your guys, some of your guys' games and game plans and stuff, that's something that, again, I mean, do you want to be right or do you want to win? And
100%.
I want to win.
Well, yeah, and I'm kind of that way now. Like, we're not gonna go get a bunch of really good 6'5", 6'6" kids at Clemson as we're starting this thing up. And so, like, what can make you different? And we were talking before air, like, for us, different's going to be we're going to be small and try to spread you out and shoot a bunch of threes. Like, that gives me at least an opportunity to have some kind of advantage on the court, because just matching size to size, because you guys have it, like, it doesn't create an advantage for me. So, like, what can give you an advantage? As a coach, you got to figure that out. What is it?
All right, we're going to move into our quick hitters segment. We're going to just throw out a couple different topics and concepts that aren't your everyday stuff and just the hoops landscape. So first one, you're a big energy guy. I know you talked about it in your press conference, talked about it already here. You model it, you practice it on the sidelines, I mean, and everything. And how do you create that authentic, meaningful energy? I think it's something a lot of programs struggle with. And when it's there's nothing, I would rather there be no energy than just the phony, false energy that your team, as soon as they walk off the court, they're like, man, that was awful.
100%. It's like anything. I mean, consistency. Like, anything you're trying to preach and live by, you better be consistent with it. And it does take time. Like, beginning of it is, I think there's a lot of, like, fake it till you make it energy, right? But then what happens is you start seeing the results of, when you're thinking about someone more than yourself, how much more success you have individually, then it's a lot easier to buy into it, and it's something we believe in. We're going to show it every single day and be consistent with it. And it's, again, you can't be really great at 10, 15, 20 things, but is there three or four you can? And one of them for us is that. And so we got to live it every day and be consistent with it, and continue to preach
Yeah, are you a coffee and up at 5 a.m. guy, or do you just have the Lord's force
it.
rolling through you at all times?
Yeah. A lot of coffee, but not at 5 a.m.
Okay. All right. Next one. If you could change one thing, you take your pick across the college basketball landscape, what would it be?
Well, I think that we got to get this NIL thing on guardrails, some guardrails to it, so we can all be as close to equal playing field, right? Like, there's a difference of if you're a coach at that institution compared to X or Y or Z, but the NIL side of things, where it's, I mean, it has gotten so out of hand. The amount of, again, not that I don't believe in it now, that's not what I'm saying, right? But we got to get some guardrails on, put it on an equal playing field for all of us, or close to it, right? Like, there's got to be a salary cap of some sort. We're not in amateur athletics anymore. It's just the reality of it. So finding a way to balance that out, so that, because I think that we got the most parity that we've ever had in women's basketball, and it's going to go away unless we get some guardrails on it.
Pretty cool. You bringing up parity in our game. I try to explain it to people all the time. Like the men's game is unbelievable. The parity in the men's game, you see it. 16s are beating ones now, and things that have never had. There's not going to be another UCLA team that goes, wins, streaks together national championships. That the parity in the game wasn't there, but with the explosion, the popularity of the game, the amount of people that are playing travel basketball. And I mean, you know, it's just crazy. So the parity on the men's game just spiked, and you're seeing that same thing happen on our side. And I think it's so, you know, I think it's so cool where the women's game is at. And you know, just, you know, being an AAU coach, you know, 12 whatever years ago, seeing the same, you know, five suckers in every gym, and we all, and there wasn't very many teams. And you know, now there's, you know, 2 feet elite from every state, you know, in the country. Yep. And there's just so many people playing, and that's going to continue to happen. And yeah, and I think unfortunately for us, being in the same league as a Drake in Northern Iowa, the Caitlin Clark effect will probably produce a million little ballers up there too. And so you know, hopefully some Iowa ballers that want to go to Kentucky or something. But I think that's a cool just little side note about the parity in our game.
Oh, absolutely. And you're right. Like, there's just so much more talent now because there's a lot of young girls that want to play, right? Because we've gotten attention to the game for the right reasons. And so while that's happening, we got it on the upswing. Let's keep it there, in my opinion.
Yeah, no doubt. Okay, last quick hitter here. When it comes to shooting, you know, and you're evaluating players, I think shooting is, it seems like every time there's you're on the fence, but when they're a no-brainer, they're a no-brainer. I think every time you're on the fence about a kid, it almost always seems like it, that's the piece of it that you're trying to figure out. And how much, you know, how much do you think you just have to recruit shooting? And how much do you look at a kid and think, you know, that kid can and will get better?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's the no-brainers for sure. We got one Hannah Cohn. She's a no-brainer. But then we got a handful of others that I think that, like Mia Moore, I felt like she should shoot more of them, and let's tighten some things up. And I think you're going to see the product of that because of how much work we put in one-on-one with it. So we're going to make you a better shooter. You got to have some confidence to shoot it, right? But I think there's a lot of them that have not maybe had the green light. There's a mentality that comes out. That's obviously, I'm talking more on the portal side of things, but even high school, do you have the confidence enough to shoot it? There's a start, right? And then the other piece of it, it may not even be their form and that kind of thing, but are they coachable, right? Are they going to be willing to put the work in and work on the little things that we talk about? Because we're going to do a lot of one-on-one with them. But if you have no confidence in the world, I can't create that. Right. And so that's kind of what we look for is really the confidence level mixed with the coachability piece, that I believe we're going to help make them a better shooter. And we've made everyone that I've been with have made better shooters if they're going to put the work in. Chattanooga, I inherited Seeger, an oldest daughter. I think she shot 20% as a freshman, 38% with us, and double the attempts, right? And some of that is we worked on it, but we also put her in positions to where she knows when she's going to get a shot. That helps too.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, as I got a little older, one of the best things that I started doing with some of the player development pieces is, you know, when you have, everybody's got some kind of system. I mean,
right. Yeah.
You know, you know, if you run a lot of pin downs, you just know the window shots, the sit down threes you're going to get, you know, the trail threes you're going to get when they're tagging. So you know, getting a volume of shots and familiar spots from familiar reads, you know, when I started doing that, you know, all of a sudden, you know, they just spiked. And it is, I mean, it's a familiarity, it's a confidence piece. Like I've made this specific shot so many freaking times, like this is nothing, you know.
I got a text the other day from a coach. I got a text the other day from a coach said, what are you doing pregame? Is it a routine? Is it scheduled? Because I just got a question, because your kids come out and get game shots, like not game in the sense of speed, game in the sense of they're getting what they end up taking in a game 90 minutes for a game every time I've watched you play. And I said, well, that's obviously a product of, yeah, we worked on their shots, but they're going to go practice the shots they get every day. And it's exactly what you just talked about, right? Are you practicing shooting, or are you practicing shots they're going to get?
Yeah, big difference. Big difference.
For sure.
Yeah, and making sure they have an imagination to understand that too and feel that.
Right.
You know, I think all that stuff, you know, plays into it. So that's awesome. All right, Coach, I'm going to throw the full court press on you. Last segment here, you're going to have 10 seconds to get it across, all right?
Yeah, I got you.
All right. I saw a clip about you guys talking about preparing for an early tip-off. You had an earlier tip-off than usual, and so you were prepping. You guys have an 11 a.m. kids game coming up. You going to be having them in there Sunday morning at 11 a.m.?
We go Saturday and Sunday, both days, 11 a.m., right? 11 a.m. We'll actually even get up early and get a meal for them on Sunday so they get the feeling of not only – practicing at 11, which would be a game, but also waking up to get a pregame meal, what that feels like too. So huge on preparation and experiencing it before you experience it.
Well, that's awesome. I hope this kids game goes great for you. We were at Arkansas last year for their kids game. They jumped on us early. We get back into it late and you know, we're making a run. Well, the kids, heck, they didn't know what was going on. They were just having the time of their life. So they start cheering for us. I mean, we were like, yeah, we were getting right. The momentum rolling. We were like, yes, let's, I mean, it was awesome. So hopefully your kids are a little more loyal to the team.
Yeah.
If you could go back 10 years and give yourself one piece of advice, what would it be?
Yeah. Be more relational from the get go. You know, I think as basketball coaches, we think basketball and X's and O's and all that stuff's good, man. But, man, if you don't have the relationship side with kids, it don't matter what you know, X's and O's. And I think it took me a while in this business to realize that. That's what I'd change 100%. Not that, again, you do look back and you probably were relational, but I would do a heck of a lot better job now that I'm much older looking back on it.
All right, last one. What is one thing that a recruit, regardless of talent level, you know, might do that'll get you off the radar? Like, what's just an absolute no, you know, I don't care how good you are, we're not taking you.
Yeah, it's just attitude towards your teammates, right? You better be a good teammate, especially with how we do things around here. So I don't care. Heat of the moment does not matter. You better be a good teammate.
That's good. I like it. We're not making excuses for you. You're a part of this thing. Let's be all in together. Coach, man, I appreciate your time. This time of year, I know everybody's got a lot going on, but I love talking basketball with you. You know, I bother you every sideline chance I get. So having you on the pod was great, man.
Well, it's good to have some more time with you, man. I feel like we're always catching up on the recruiting trail or obviously watching you from afar is your guys' system. I'd love to get you on a separate call sometime, just your philosophy and how you guys are doing things up there. It's unique and definitely a fan from afar. So I appreciate you having me on this.
Yep, for sure. Good luck, man.
All right, you too. Thank you.
For sure. All right, at the buzzer with my closing thoughts. We are called the Coach's Playbook Podcast, so I thought it would be awesome to share this must-add quick hit that Harvard women's ran against Indiana. They were down 3 end of the game. They ran a really nice double stagger ball screen where the second screener ghosted out pretty early and loops back around, and the first guy's diving out. They end up hitting that shot, send the game to overtime where they got a big road win in overtime. And I think this is easy to implement, and no matter what the coverage teams are running, really hard to defend and an easy way to get a shooter an open look, whether they're a post or a guard. All right, let's take a look.
All the way at half court, they have 20 on the shot clock. Now the ball is in the hands of Harmony Turner. Two defenders on her. Give some time for Rocco. She takes a 3 and it hits it.
All right, that's a wrap for the show. Please feel free to like and subscribe and share the show with any basketball junkies out there you know. Make sure to tune in as we drop our next episode, 8 a.m. Eastern Time on Tuesday. Until then, keep adding to your playbook.